From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A Western Michigan congressman well known for bucking the Republican Party line considers a run for president as a libertarian.
He's never been a member of the Libertarian Party up until last night when he announced that he was joining the Libertarian Party and looking at a run for president.
Stay tuned for more on Justin Amash's big announcement. Also, another congressman weighs questions of physical and economic survival during COVID.
People are universal in the sense that even up in the more rural parts of my district where the numbers aren't that great, there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear.
Dan Kildee checks in today. And a new novel catches the darker side of small-town Michigan life.
There's just a kind of community mindset, I guess, that I didn't fit into, and I wanted to capture that feeling.
We meet writer Jenny McFarland on today's show. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later in the show, West Michigan Congressman Justin Amash considers a run for president as a libertarian. Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer will join us to break down why this story has observers across the political spectrum buzzing.
There had been speculation, if you go online, a lot of people who support libertarians had been kind of hoping for Justin Amash to get in the race for a long time.
But first, Congress is digging in on a fifth round of aid to try to help Americans make it through the COVID-19 pandemic. Democratic House leaders have a new proposal to federalize the nation's medical supply chain. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican, says any new bill must include liability protections from what he calls an avalanche of potential lawsuits against businesses that reopen. Congressman Dan Kildee represents Michigan's 5th District. It includes places like Flint, Bay City, and Saginaw. And he joins us now. Congressman Kildee, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So Speaker Pelosi decided not to bring congressional members back to D.C. next week due to the threat of COVID-19. We should mention the Senate will be in session. Do you think that the Speaker made the right decision, or is that a call that could have been made earlier?
It probably could have been made earlier. She did that in consultation with the Office of the Attending Physician. And to be clear, the Senate is in not to deal with COVID-19 legislation, but to push through judicial nominations. So I think the Speaker's decision, and I support this, is we will go to Washington. We will be there to take important action regarding the COVID-19 crisis. But until that moment occurs, we can continue to work from home. We have committee sessions from home. I had one yesterday on the Budget Committee. I have one today with the Ways and Means Committee. So we can continue to craft the legislation, but follow the best guidance and set the best example we can by only taking the step of traveling to Washington when important legislation related to COVID-19 is necessary for us to be there. So I think it was the right call.
Well, you're in your fifth term now. How would you say what's happening in this moment ranks among some of the challenges that you've seen so far? Impeachment, the attempt to repeal Obamacare, school shootings, just any number of foreign policy issues?
Well, there's nothing quite like what we're going through right now, because this is a global issue, and it's one that no one can avoid. You know, it's very easy for people to pretend some of these other issues don't exist. And in fact, part of the difficulty that we have in dealing with these other big questions that we face is that it's easy for some policymakers to just pretend they're not there. Not with this.
Well, not even just policymakers. I mean, you represent a relatively diverse part of Michigan, everything from Genesee County and Flint, which has some 1,500 confirmed cases of COVID, to Aranac County, which has barely 20 cases. Right. How do you think about the needs of people in both places?
Well, I think, you know, people are universal in the sense that even up in, you know, the more rural parts of my district where the numbers aren't that great, there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear. I think the way people are approaching this, first and foremost, is, at least in Michigan, and certainly in the district I represent, they're looking at this as a healthcare crisis that has an economic consequence, and that we have to be able to manage both. But at the heart of it, they're not distinct issues. So when sometimes, and this maybe is implicit in the question, sometimes people think, well, this is a financial crisis, this is an economic crisis, or it's a healthcare crisis. It's all one and the same. People are dealing with it in different ways. It's affecting different communities in different ways. But I think ultimately, when our backs are against the wall, what do we think about? We think about protecting our families. And I think that's universal.
Yeah. The federal government has committed trillions of dollars to get the nation through the first spike of the outbreak. What budget cuts do you foresee will need to be taken to continue to balance COVID spending with everything else that's going on, defense and social security, or like what programs might be a possibility?
Well, I don't think we'd want to undo anything that's essential to the social safety net, like Social Security, for example, or Medicaid. What we're seeing is the need for that kind of economic and health security is important in dealing with the crisis we're in now. So we wouldn't want to weaken that safety net, leading into what might be the next crisis. But I think we have to be honest and realistic that we are spending money that we don't have. We're having to borrow it in order to spend it. I think we're going to have to take a hard look in the mirror at revenues. You know, there was a massive tax cut put into effect just 3 years ago that cost just about as much as all of the money that we're spending on COVID-19 cost. And I've been a long advocate of thoughtful and I think more critical look at the way we align our national defense. We have a base configuration, a military base configuration that expects the Cold War and World War II and World War I all to be fought simultaneously. I mean, it's ridiculous. We need to think carefully about how to use our precious national defense dollars. And I think there may be some savings there. But, you know, in the moment, in the crisis, we spend what we have to spend to save lives. And then we're going to have to get serious about figuring out how we reconcile all of this.
There are some pretty deep divisions between the House and the Senate about whether and how further spending on stimulus and recovery should go forward. House leaders said no to some liability protections that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wanted. Just to explain, making sure that cities and counties would not be liable for civil suits claiming that they hadn't done enough to prevent the spread of the virus. Just to play this out, might something like that be important in towns that had a high percentage of, say, water shutoffs and a high number of COVID-19 cases, like maybe Flint?
Yeah, of course, in Flint, we have a moratorium on water shutoffs right now, so we're actually turning people back on. I think there's room for a real serious conversation about how state and local governments should be supported. We are of the view that because so many of these state and local governments are simultaneously having to increase spending to deal with COVID-19 and are seeing huge revenue losses, particularly those municipalities and states that are dependent on sales tax or income tax, that there has to be an honest discussion about this. I've been blowing the horn about the need for municipal and state finance reform ever since I've been in Congress. And suddenly all of this is ripped off all of these weaknesses in our systems when we're dealing with this pandemic. So, you know, I think there's reasonable reforms that can be in place, but right now there's a big hole in the boat and we need to plug that hole. Otherwise, the crisis will actually get worse.
You've worked on some huge problems, the response to Flint's water crisis, contamination at the old Wordsmith Air Force Base. The pandemic we're going through right now might stand out even among those. How do you think about what should be done and the limits to how much the federal government can do?
Well, I mean, this is one of those areas where I think the president's framing, while I don't think his response has been very precise, his framing was pretty good, where he says this is a war. This is a wartime president because we're fighting something that is a threat to everything that we find precious, the lives of our families, the economy that we build, the communities that we're a part of. And so there are times when the country has to sort of all rally, and it becomes the patriotic thing to do to recognize that we're going to have to take big and bold action in order to deal with this problem. That's where I think we are. Where I think we're falling short, to be honest with you, is that we're too quickly defaulting to two camps, which is sort of the shut everything down or open everything up camp. And we saw that played out in the protests that took place in Lansing.
Public health or jobs.
Yeah. And the truth of the matter is we ought to be guided by the best available science. The point being that it's not just about the amount of financial resources that we commit to the problem, but how thoughtfully we target the use of those dollars. And so I'm very much biased in favor of a huge increase in testing capacity, in contact tracing, and then isolating those people who need to be isolated because of their situation or because they test positive, and use an approach that doesn't create this false dichotomy of being able to thoughtfully stand up the economy or being able to protect public health. I think there's actually, with the right resource, target in the right direction, there's a way to do both in a way that doesn't put either at risk, at any greater risk than unnecessarily so.
We have less than a minute left here. I was just wondering how your uncle is doing. Dale Kildee preceded you in your seat for 20 plus years, and a lot of people remember him fondly. How is he?
He's a great guy. He's 90 years old, and he's doing well. We chat from time to time. He's a cable news watcher, so when he sees me on one of the national networks, I get a call and we talk it over. But he's just been a great teacher for me for so long, and he continues to be a real inspiration. But I'll mention to him that you asked. He'll be happy to hear that.
Congressman Kildee, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dan Kildee represents Michigan's 5th District. Growing up in Western Michigan, writer Jenny McFarland felt like an outsider. Her new novel dives deep to find the scared kid in all her characters.
There's a way in which victims, especially victims who have been told to be quiet, feel guilty about what happened to them. And it's not logical. It's not their fault.
Meet her in just a moment. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. A long drive home might be a time to savor. You might look forward to catching up with your folks. Maybe think about all those people you haven't seen in a while, old friends you want to connect with. For Beth DeWitt, one of the protagonists in Jenny McFarland's new novel, House of Deep Water, that drive home is dreadful. Let's listen to McFarland reading from the book.
The house had blurred in her mind over the years. In the darkness, it seems to have grown larger. She knows it's painted pale yellow, but for the life of her, she now has trouble making it out against the sky. There is no moon out tonight. The alley behind her is dark, the street lamp burnt out. She stares at her father's house, trying to discern the pitch of the roof, the stairs leading up to the back door, anything. She should be able to find a happy memory of it. This is the house where she spent her early childhood, the house where they lived when her family was still whole. And yet, even as she strains her mind, all she can come up with are memories of Gilmer Thurber here, in this house, his presence in every corner, filling the house like dark water. The longer she stares, the harder it is to see, so that she finds herself turning away, giving the house the side eye, trying to trick it into materializing. Next to her, Dan snores quietly. Jeanette shifts in her sleep and gives an unhappy whimper. Beth knows the house stands there, yet the lot seems to be full of stars in space, with distant planets dotting the wall facing her. The Milky Way is folded into the roof. Her eyes are sore and dry. She finds herself dozing, her head drooping onto her chest, and then her eyes blink open. She could close them, just for a second, if only her mind would quiet. Instead, she stares at the house until its eastern-facing wall grows pale, until the sky around blues and brightens. At first, she thinks it's a trick of the light, but as the dawn comes on stronger, the house turns blue and stays blue. It's been painted recently, she realizes. It's only the third week in September, and the mulberry tree in the backyard is a sunny yellow, its leaves dropping onto the grass beneath. A light goes on inside the kitchen, and she can see her father, Ernest DeWitt, through the gauzy curtains, poking around in the fridge, the pantry, making coffee. At the sink, he pauses, tilts his head, then reaches out and pushes the curtains aside. "Wake up," Beth says quietly, and when Dan stirs next to her, she adds, "We're here." She has to tell herself, "Get out of the car, go inside the house." She shakes her head. Dan wakes his sister, and Jeanette comes briefly to life in that moment when her body is awake before her brain has booted up. "It's morning," Jeanette says. "I slept in a car all night." She seems proud of this fact, like it's the kind of bohemian lifestyle she's always longed for. Even as her kids open doors and stretch in the new sun, even as Beth's father greets his grandchildren for the first time since they were little, Beth has to keep telling herself, "Get out of the car." Jeanette walks right up to Ernest DeWitt and hugs him, and something inside Beth stirs violently. She spills out of the driver's seat and onto the driveway. "Eliza," her father says, and just hearing her childhood name makes her bowels turn to ice. He has his arms held open to her. She doesn't want to forgive him so easily. She doesn't want to hug him, doesn't want to be here, yet here she is, standing dumb and tired in the driveway as the smile he wears grows strained around the eyes. His face sags at the jowls, his glasses are crooked on his nose, and she finds herself staring at him. She'd forgotten the details of his face, and she wonders briefly whether he really is her father. They look nothing alike, and not just because he's white. The round, upturned nose, too small for his face, and the fleshy jaw. His arms, those strong, tan arms, go heavy, they droop, and Beth inserts herself into them to prop them up. "It's good to see you," he says, and kisses her forehead. "When did you get in? I was waiting, but I fell asleep on the couch." "You painted the house," is all Beth can say. "It was Linda's idea," he says, and turns as the back door claps shut. There, standing on the stoop, is a girl Beth recognizes immediately. Dirty blonde hair, a little too much makeup smudged from sleep. Linda Williams. When she was in high school, Beth used to babysit the Williams girls. Linda would have been about 10, old enough to stay home alone, really, except her mother seemed keen to foist the girls off on anyone else. Beth wonders what her father is doing with this child, but it occurs to her that, creepy as it is, the relationship makes a kind of sense. There's something of the child in Ernest's gaze, something that feels like a game of hide and seek. When you look into his eyes, you might catch a glimpse of a shoe or pigtail disappearing around a corner, but when you follow it, it's gone. Speaking with Ernest, it's easy to lose all track of the present. You're so focused on seeking out the child, hiding. Beth has always hated this about her father. She has only ever wanted him to grow up. A bit of a hypocrisy, really, given that she too has a child inside her, that she had felt the child stirring, shifting in sleep when her father called her Eliza. Her anger at her father is in part anger at her own inner child, whom Beth can't seem to shake. "So nice to see you again," Linda says, sidling up next to Ernest, inserting herself between father and daughter. Beth remembers Linda as a horse girl who always smelled like hay and manure. Now her hair is unusually full and glossy. Her fingernails are too long for a farm girl's. None of this is to be overlooked. Even so, Linda stands with her hands on her belly, still flat like a 20-something's. Beth notes Linda's rosy cheeks, her pudgy face. Beth closes her eyes. Her father has put a child in this child.
Beth DeWitt is one of several characters having a hard time coming to terms with small-town life. McFarlane, who lives in Chelsea, weaves her characters into a tense ensemble piece set in a fictional Michigan town on the western side of the state. There are family dramas, hidden trauma, betrayal, and collision after collision among people who know each other's soft targets. House of Deep Water was published in late March. Jenny McFarlane joins us today. Jenny, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here.
Jenny, you were born in Grand Rapids. So I'd like to begin with the question that I'm sure every writer who produces a tangled family drama loves to answer. Will you tell me about where you grew up?
So I lived in Wyoming, the outskirts of Grand Rapids, until I was 11. And then we moved to Constantine, which is a farm village that might look a bit like Riverbend, although I assure you Riverbend is a fictionalized, it's a town in and of itself. It's different.
Right. What was it about small town life and your experience of it that you wanted most to catch?
You know, there's, It's really complicated. There's definitely a closeness and a community in small town life that I missed when I was living elsewhere. But there's also, there are ways in which I never felt like I fit in the town where I grew up. And not just because I was one of the few people of color. I was also into the arts and, you know, sports were the thing to be into. I really loved school, which was not cool, but yeah, there's just a kind of community mindset, I guess, that I didn't fit into. And I wanted to capture that feeling.
Part of what gives the novel depth is the deep emotional empathy that you build up for several key characters in the story. There are traditionally sympathetic characters in this, like Beth DeWitt, who we just heard from. She's returning to her hometown with a couple of sort of surly teenagers in tow. And this young woman, Linda Williams, who's tumbled into a December-May relationship with Beth's dad. But also Linda's mom, Paula, who's been on the run and out of state, sort of escaping her own messy past. She's a character who's committed one of the most cardinal maternal sins, I guess, in literature, having walked away from her children when they were still pretty small. Why did it matter to make readers feel for the, you know, characters who are less admirable?
I mean, I think that especially in Paula's case, it, you know, like she left, but and that is like a major cardinal sin for a mother. But I think that not all women are maternal. Not all women are supposed to be mothers. And I don't know. I just wanted to capture the other side of these stories that you don't often see.
I was fascinated with another character that you built into the story with empathy, a guy named Steve, who has an affair with one of the main characters. And this is the kind of person who just can't seem to stay out of marital trouble. Mm-hmm. And you really turned him inside out so we could see what makes him tick. He's someone who manipulates women into relationships, but you also show that he wants very badly to understand them. Like in his head, he's never going to have an interesting job. He's never going to be a great parent or a great friend in life. But by God, he's going to have these adventures exploring women's inner lives. It was I wasn't sure if, you know, he's not the most key character in the book, but I just understood a little bit more about the women in his life because of the way he thinks about them.
Yeah, he was a difficult character to write for me. I patterned some of his family and some of his actions after somebody that I knew, and it wasn't somebody that I wanted to get to know or give the benefit of the doubt to. So I really struggled on his character, but I think that in the end, like even the unlikable or the, I guess, kind of anti-hero type characters are real people too, right? So we need to look past the surface and see what makes them tick.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jenny McFarland. She has a new novel called The House of Deep Water, set in Western Michigan. The book includes some really frank takes on what it's like being someone who feels like she's on the outside of a small Midwestern town. It's not the source of Beth's trauma and rage exactly, but it's clear she's been deeply scarred as you say, one of the few biracial people in Riverbend her whole life. How central was her experience to the story that was working its way out of you as you were writing this novel?
In early drafts, I think I really skirted around her character and her traumas. I think I wasn't quite ready to address them yet, but it really is the meat of this novel. I think that Beth is she's really struggling and she's hurting, and these are things that I have experienced. So yeah, she is the central character.
Not everybody in this book has the same problem, but in their problems, they all kind of meet at a similar crossroads. It seems like the question that each of them is asking themselves is, do I really have what it takes to pull myself out of this emotional mess that I'm in? Do you think most people do have that within them?
I think they do. I think that I'm a big proponent of therapy. I think that if you're a person who's alive in this planet, that you could benefit from therapy. I think that it would help a lot of people to bring out that inner strength to move past those hard points in your life. But yeah, I think everybody has it in them.
I treasure the fact that the book club kit for this novel includes a recipe for Frito pie. Although I have to say I was a little bummed not to see any iceberg lettuce in your particular varietal.
Oh.
do you want to talk about your essential, what's included in your essential recipe?
Yeah, so I've actually never made Frito pie exactly.
What?
Sorry, we were a tuna noodle casserole kind of family, not Frito pie. But I did, we would make chili and put like Fritos and cheese, which is the essence of Frito pie. But yeah, no, we never put lettuce on there.
was Frito pie sort of a part of your younger life? And you just felt this needed to be there to sort of ground readers who may not have the Michigan experience?
Yeah, no, food is super important to me. I used to be a chef, so I wanted a lot of good food in there.
Yeah. We should mention you moved back to Michigan not too long ago after several years living in several different states.
I did, yeah. I moved back just in time for winter.
Way to go. Are you finding things very much as you left them?
Sure. So when I left, I was living in Ann Arbor. I'm in Chelsea now, which is a small town. And honestly, it's been a blessing during this COVID-19 situation,
Just
because some space to like go out in the world without encountering other people. So I think I'm benefiting a lot from small town life right now.
Yeah, I'm sure things look differently at different stages of life, too.
Yes, yeah.
I'd like to get back for a minute to Beth, one of the central characters in the book. Beth is a woman who's on the verge of an explosion, partly because she just has a really messy personal life. She's running away from a bad marriage, and she's, you know, just trying to figure out what the heck her relationship is with her dad. But she's also dealing with sexual abuse that she suffered as a child. And this is something that also you've talked about, the fact that this was something that happened to you as a kid. Beth has not spoken a word of this to anyone ever. Did you learn anything as you were writing through her story about the relative costs of keeping those stories bottled up versus what it costs to tell them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the moment towards the end of the book where Jeanette has this moment and she kind of is like, oh, I see what happened. Jeanette is her daughter. She's 12 going on 30. I think it really just opens things up for like it opens Beth up in a way that she hasn't been before. It's like a relief to her to be able to see that someone can know this about her and not hate her for it. Because there's a way in which victims, especially victims who have been told to be quiet, feel guilty about what happened to them. And it's not logical. It's not their fault. We know this logically, but there's like this primitive part of your brain that doesn't fully grasp that. To like unbottle that silence is the most freeing thing in the world.
This story feels a little like an inversion of a chosen family. There are a lot of characters in the book who get thrown together without a lot of regard for, you know, whether they have something to offer each other or whether they're a good fit for each other. You know, there are bad marriages and friendships that have gone sour. There are old relatives who get sick and people who get pregnant. I mean, just life is happening all over the place in this book. I was wondering which has been more important to you, your chosen family or the people you kind of ended up with in the life lottery?
I mean, I think they're both equally important, but for different reasons. The people that I ended up with in the life lottery, they're the people who have been with me from the beginning. They understand things that other people can never understand. But my chosen family is also where I draw a lot of my strength from, and a lot of comfort. So I think they're both super important to me.
I sometimes think that each book changes writers in a little different way as they're tackling the challenges of the story. This is your first novel, but I was curious how, if House of Deepwater made a different kind of writer out of you, and if so, how?
Yeah, I'm not really sure how, but I definitely, like, I look back at, there's an early draft of this that is bound as my master's thesis, and it's a very different book. It's, in a lot of ways, it's shallower. I think this book has maybe taught me to dive into the hard topics, even if they feel insurmountable. And I'm trying to be a braver writer as I start my second novel.
Do you think this book helped you get there?
Yeah, I think it did. I think this book helped me to address a lot of things that I had been silent about for much of my life, and to see that people can read this and know this about me and accept it. And I think so.
Jenny McFarland is the author of the new novel, House of Deepwater, which is available now. You might also want to check out her short story, Growth, in Crack the Spine. Jenny, we're so glad we had you on the show today. And hey, the weather's getting better. You hang in there.
Thank you. You too.
Coming up, Justin Amash's exploratory campaign for a presidential run and what it might mean for both Donald Trump and Joe Biden. You're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There are many Michigan businesses that are not hiring right now. Those that are getting a strong discouragement from hiring foreign-born workers. The Trump administration has made a proclamation designed to strictly curtail immigration. The order temporarily bans folks with job offers from getting resident status, and it also stops green card holders from sponsoring a spouse or a child for permanent residency. With us to discuss this a little further is Steve Tobachman, a former state lawmaker and the executive director of Global Detroit. Steve, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Who are some of the folks who might be waiting on permanent residency right now, what a lot of us refer to commonly as a green card?
Yeah. So it's kind of complicated because what the president tweeted out and what he said is different from what has been issued thus far. So when we're talking about what actually happened, we are talking about the fact that people are not able to go into foreign offices of the U.S. consulate to get their green card application processed. It turns out that that was already the impact of undergoing COVID-19, but the length of time that that's going on was extended last week all the way, I believe, until I think it's the end of June right now. It's a 60-day order, I believe.
Right.
So it was really an extension of what was kind of going on. It was grounded in a sort of a different rationale, and it was specific to issuing green cards as opposed to closing the foreign consulates. So the reality is the consulates are closed to all visitors, not just those seeking green cards, but this extends the ban on getting a green card from a consulate abroad. Now, what is not impacted are those who are seeking green cards who are already here and those seeking citizenship. Moreover, you know, what's so confusing is that the president said this was to protect American workers, but none of the temporary worker programs, including those for skilled immigrant workers, you know, under the H-1B or guest workers for migrant workers
who might be coming to help with spring farm work. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They're not impacted by anything that was announced thus far last week. So it seems kind of misguided. It's not directed at those who we would say are competing with American workers. Now, it does impact the visa lottery. It does impact a lot of family members who are seeking to be reunited with their American relatives. So if you're trying to get your parents into the country, your brother into the country, and you're already here legally, and you're trying to make an application, it is going to impact you for the next 60 days.
You know, I heard what you said about the fact that it's more of an extension than a new rule, but can you give us an example of what kinds of workers in Michigan industries might be affected by this right now? I mean, again, it's sort of a strange time in terms of hiring and employee retention with everything that's happening with the COVID-related shutdown.
Right. So the workers who typically come to Michigan to help with our crop production, one of our, you know, important industries, the workers who would work in northern Michigan in our tourism industry, and the skilled workers who come to work in computer science, IT, and engineering jobs around our auto industry or those who would come to fill critical needs in the medical industry, they are not impacted by the order, although ostensibly that's what the president said he wanted to impact. Who is impacted are a variety of folks who are coming to the United States, usually for family reasons or to pursue the American dream because it is, you know, still a great beacon of freedom and opportunity across the world. And families that are already here who are trying to bring over relatives, those are the people who are really impacted by this. This, to me, unfortunately, you know, we should be having discussions on how we get our workforce back to work. And frankly, from our perspective and from research, being inclusive of immigrant talent and making sure that American companies can compete and fill critical shortages is a job creator for American workers. And that the best way out of this crisis, where we see as much as 1 in 6 Americans unemployed right now, is to continue with the immigration policies that we've had that helped us get to, you know, historic lows in unemployment. And so we think that's the pathway forward. Unfortunately, what we're seeing, I believe, is, you know, the president has signed on to a number of immigration proposals over the last few years that curb the number of legal migrants, that suggest that the president supports only half of the amount of immigration to the United States. And we think that that actually is going to hurt American workers because it's going to make the economy dysfunctional. Unfortunately, with rapidly aging community that we have here in Michigan, we know that food production, agriculture production, food processing, our manufacturers, and our service industries need more labor, particularly, you know, labor that works some very difficult jobs that pay low wages, but also some very high-skilled jobs that require specialized, you know, education and skill.
Yeah.
And so immigrants have been a perfect complement to the Michigan workforce.
At a time when many U.S. businesses, and certainly Michigan businesses, are simply struggling to get through the moment, does the state's competitive advantage have as much meaning as it did maybe a year ago?
Oh, I think it's going to be even more important. You know, the reality is, as the global economy is dealing with this crisis, you know, there's going to be less demand for cars. There's going to be less demand for furniture. There's going to be a more competitive global business environment. And if Michigan can't produce goods and services at the level of our other North American or European or Asian competitors, we're going to be left behind in this recovery. So we need to have a fully functioning economy for our companies to get back online. You know, the reality is it's great to get more car production going, but if we're not continuing to innovate around the vehicles and design them in the right ways, we will never be able to have American cars sold in the next, you know, coming years. And that unfortunately requires a global workforce. It requires some very highly skilled positions that we compete across the world for.
Why is the ban on sponsoring family members significant?
The ban on family members to me doesn't have much impact on the economy. And that's why it's hard to understand the actions that the Trump administration took after the rhetoric that we were doing this to help American workers. That's what's so confusing, is that we seem to have implemented policies that are largely impacting families, largely impacting those who are desiring to come to the United States to pursue the American dream and opportunity and freedom. And we have not narrowly tailored the actions to protect American workers in any kind of way, shape, or form. So while we disagree with the intent that American workers are somehow helped by restricting immigration, we also know that what was put into place was not narrowly tailored to impact American workers.
How would you describe the position that immigrants hold at this moment when the country is in the grip of a pandemic?
Immigrants are suffering just like other Americans during this crisis. In fact, many immigrants are in those emergency jobs that are on the front lines of working at grocery stores, of working in kitchens, in restaurants, of taking care of elderly and home health care workers, and even nurses. So our immigrant communities are among our country's heroes in responding to the crisis. We know that immigrants are hurting economically, that often they are in jobs that are the first jobs to be cut, and they're the first ones to be put on the unemployment line. Many of the stimulus programs that we have created explicitly exclude a variety of immigrant classes, including legal immigrants. And in fact, they also impact American citizens who may be married to immigrants, the stimulus payments. So the immigrant community is not necessarily sharing in all of the government supports that we've created to respond to the crisis. And in fact, some of the programs from which they are shut out are programs that they help pay taxes to support. So this is a really critical moment, obviously, for America, for American workers, for our communities. And we believe that, you know, immigrants are very much a part of those communities. Here in Michigan, immigrants are 7% of the population. They've been almost all of the population growth that the state has experienced in the last 10 in 20 years. And they are filling critical job shortages and are contributing members to our communities. And when we think of responses to the COVID-19 pandemic, we should be thinking of ways in which we include immigrants as well as all American citizens to address the needs within our communities. And so we're working hard to make sure they have access to information.
Steve Tobachman is the Executive Director of Global Detroit. Steve, good to talk to you.
Thanks.
Last night, political Twitter was lit up like a Christmas tree with news that Representative Justin Amash, former Republican of Western Michigan, is launching an exploratory committee for the 2020 presidential nomination. If he runs, he will do so as a libertarian. His statement said, and I'm quoting here, "Americans are ready for practical approaches based in humility and trust of the people." There are many in the GOP who were one-time Amash supporters who've turned tail and run from him, or perhaps even come out viciously against his record. But Justin Amash has been nothing if not consistent in his libertarian perspective and approach to a smaller, less intrusive government. Let's listen to this segment from his floor speech during impeachment proceedings against President Trump.
I come to this floor not as a Democrat, not as a Republican, but as an American who cares deeply about the Constitution, the rule of law, and the rights of the people. Under our system of government, impeachment is not about policy disagreements or ineffective governance, nor is it about criminality based on statutes that did not exist at the time our Constitution was written. Impeachment is about maintaining the integrity of the office of the presidency and ensuring that executive power is directed toward proper ends in accordance with the law. President Donald J. Trump has abused and violated the public trust by using his high office to solicit the aid of a foreign power, not for the benefit of the United States of America, but instead for his personal and political gain. His actions reflect precisely the type of conduct the framers of the Constitution intended to remedy through the power of impeachment, and it is our duty to impeach him.
And now that Congressman, Justin Amash, is considering running for president to replace Trump. With us now with more on the story is Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer joining us from Grand Rapids. Hey, Dustin.
Hey, April. How's it going?
Good. So for those who may be outside of the 3rd Congressional District, can you recap who is Justin Amash?
Well, he's the congressional representative for this area, for Grand Rapids, for the district that includes both Grand Rapids and Battle Creek. He was first elected as a Republican in 2010. He was one of the youngest members of Congress when he ran for that race. He's an Arab American. His father was a refugee from Palestine. His mother is Syrian. And he has always had a bit of an independent streak. He has identified previously ideologically as a libertarian, but he's never been a member of the Libertarian Party up until last night when he announced that he was joining the Libertarian Party and looking at a run for president.
He broke with the Republican Party last year. Why was his split with the GOP such a big deal?
Because of when it happened. I mean, Justin Amash has always bucked his party, going back to the days when he was a state representative and working in Lansing. But what happened last year was he went against Donald Trump right around the time that the Mueller report came out. He was at the time the only Republican who read the Mueller report and said that he believed there was impeachable conduct in the findings of the Mueller report. He called for hearings. He called for an impeachment hearing. Of course, that impeachment hearing didn't happen over the Mueller report, but then later there was an impeachment hearing. And that's about when he split. It was July 4th when Justin Amash announced that he was leaving the Republican Party.
The man can surely choose a date, I suppose. He
yeah.
said nothing else.
He
about
said at
him.
The time, he came on stateside last year to talk about that, and he said the symbolism of that date to declare his independence on Independence Day was meaningful to him.
So the exploratory committee that he's going to take on now to see if he should run for president, did that come as a surprise to those who know him and his career?
I think in some ways it did. There had been speculation, if you go online, a lot of people who support libertarians had been kind of hoping for Justin Amash to get in the race for a long time. People who know Justin had kind of wondered, at least those who talked to me had kind of wondered what his plans were. In February, he announced he was pausing his congressional reelection campaign to look into this. So, of course, people had some heads up that there might be something coming. But the timing of it was a surprise to people I knew.
What are some theories about what this candidacy might do if Justin Amash decides, yeah, I'm going to enter the race?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many theories, April. I mean, it seems that half people believe he might take votes away from Joe Biden. Half the people believe he might take votes away from Donald Trump. No one right now is really sure. And there hasn't been a ton of polling on this. There was recently Morning Consult did a poll that suggested he might only get 1% of the vote if he entered the race. And some of that would come from Biden. Some of it would come from Trump. Of course, we have to consider that he's from Michigan, and Michigan had a really tight presidential race in 2016. The difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton that year was only 10,000 votes. So a big question is, what does it do to Michigan's electoral votes? Will it tilt at least this one state in the race if he gets in?
Dustin, I've got one for you. Justin Amash's seat is up for re-election this year. Let's say he decides to run for president. Can he still run trying to retain his seat in Congress at the same time?
So technically, according to state law, I believe he can. He said in an interview that was posted this morning with Reason magazine that he doesn't intend to run for the seat. And of course, that seat, his campaign had been on pause since February, although some people had continued to donate to Justin Amash through March. And again, even his congressional race could be a very close race. There's a Democrat in the race, Hillary Scolton, who's running. It seems that Peter Meyer is one of the leading candidates for the Republican nomination. And it could be a close race. And even if Justin Amash isn't actively campaigning, but his name remains on the ballot, or even people just choose to write him in, it could have an impact on the 3rd Congressional District as well.
Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer. Dustin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that's it for Stateside for today. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with Politico senior correspondent Tim Alberta about Governor Gretchen Whitmer's handling of the COVID-19 shutdown.
You could not find one person who had anything really negative to say, and that was including her early handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. There was just a real sense that Republican leaders in the State House were on the same page with her, that they had her back, that this was not going to descend into partisan bickering.
Oh, how things change during a global viral outbreak. That conversation can be heard tomorrow right here on Stateside. Our show's producers are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.